It's now my pleasure to introduce our first speaker for this afternoon's session, Richard Thornton. Dr. Richard Thornton is the Chief Executive Officer of the Bushfires and Natural Hazards CRC. It's a position he's held since the CRC was founded in 2013. He's responsible to the board and has overall responsibility for the direction and performance of the center. He's a highly experienced research management executive with over 20 years in the field, previously with the Bushfire CRC and previously with Telstra. He has a physics background, so he should know what an anemometer is, and has worked in science field including nuclear and semiconductor physics, computational fluid mechanics. I think people always say this because they want to look smart next to actuaries, because that's actually something we don't know much about. IT and telecommunications engineering and online services, primarily in the private sector. So please welcome Richard to the lectern. Thank you.
Thank you. I will say, just to add to that, because this is my story about where I came from, when I was little and at high school, and you go through with your careers teacher, the one thing that we went through and we said, well, what's your ideal job into the future? And you go tick all the boxes in the survey. And it came out that I should have been an actuary. So this is my opportunity to actually meet my career goal and talk to actuaries. I'm going to talk a bit about the various aspects of, I guess, what the CRC does, because we're a bit of a resource for this sector. You don't know it, but we are. So I'm just going to talk a bit through what we do, why we do it, but also make some comments around what I believe some of the key issues are as we look at the community impact. The Cooperative Research Centre is funded by the Commonwealth, partly. So we get money from the Commonwealth Government through the Cooperative Research Centre scheme. We've got $47 million over 8 years in cash from the Commonwealth. That's matched, more than matched, by cash and in-kind from the states and territories and from a number of other partners, including the Red Cross, who you'll hear from in a moment. But also, more importantly, we bring together just about every response agency across the across the country, land management agencies, SES, and a bunch of emergency management planning people. So largely, our base at the moment is largely government, but that doesn't mean that we don't stray either side of that into other areas. We have around 30 end users organisations. We tend to use approximate numbers because it depends on how you count them, because some of our end users were whole of state. Places like Tasmania, South Australia and Northern Territory joined as a whole of state. We have around about 20 research organisations, and that includes most of the major universities, but also includes the Bureau of Meteorology and Geoscience Australia. More than 200 researchers to draw on, more than 100 PhD students associated with the centre. So we're a significant player, I guess, with the national centre or national focus for hazard research in Australia, and we spill across into New Zealand. We work closely with the other initiatives around the world, particularly New Zealand and in the US and across in Europe, particularly around fire. We focus on the large-scale problems that we have, so the discussions this morning were really good because a lot of those problems that we're getting to of who owns the risk are at the core of what we do, because risk ownership, if you don't own the risk, then you don't treat it, and if we don't know who owns the risk, then it's not being treated at all. So we look at multi-hazard approaches. Most of our projects are multi-hazard, and they're not about whether it's cyclone or flood or whatever. We want to have a sizable impact, and we want to make sure that everything we do has a path to use. So I'm going to make some brief observations. We were only given a relatively short time compared to the talks this morning. But communities, I mean, the reason that we do what we do, and particularly if you look in the government side of business, is because at the end of the day, the hazards are impacting on people. And it's the people that drive the politics around what do we want to do about risk reduction. If the people are happy to live, which they seem to be, in a country which is naturally blessed with many hazards, clearly there's been a decision somewhere in that process, but it may not be an active and and conscious decision. How do we know how much risk the community is likely, is willing to accept? And that's one of those big questions out there. How do we know what is an acceptable level of risk for the community? Where does insurance fit in the continuum of management of the risks that we see and community well-being and community resilience? So there's a whole lot of those bigger ticket questions about what are we actually trying to achieve with this, because I think insurance and the role that insurance plays is a critical part of the value chain. I think it was said this morning that insurance shouldn't be driving the mitigation agenda, but it does. At the end of the day, the insurance sector reaches out to communities and talks to communities and has a valid reason to talk about risk. Nobody else does that, largely. So there's a whole load of things that we're trying to do. The bottom line is we're trying to stop the pain and suffering that's related to an impact of a natural hazard on a community, whether that's the financial impact, but we also then need to understand what the emotional impact is, and I'll come to that in just a moment. This is a group of actuaries, so I have to have some numbers, otherwise it's just pictures. The challenge we have in Australia is driven largely by a number of factors. One is demographics. Australia is predicted to get bigger and it's predicted to get older, which has a whole load of issues around the expanding rural-urban interface. We have to find somewhere for roughly 50% of our population again to live in Australia. So where are they going to go? At the moment, they're largely all going into hazardous areas on the outsides of our cities. So we've got the tree changes and the sea changes. We've got more people who are vulnerable in our communities. The way in which we live in the rural environment has actually changed dramatically, and the number of volunteers that are out there to reduce the impact of hazards is actually dropping as well. The other is the impact of which hazards are important, and that depends on your point of view. Extreme heat kills more people than all hazards put together in Australia. So that's the big killer. It's not the biggest insurance loss, though, because that sits down in the storms and the hails and the cyclones. Bushfire gets the most political influences. So we need to recognise all of those different things across the spectrum and leverage each of those where it makes sense to get the mitigation that we need to stop the impacts. We do a lot of work post-events, and we'll undoubtedly do work following the fires in Victoria and the fires in New South Wales at the moment. What do we know? We know that communities understand that they live in risky areas. And it goes without saying across whether it's the 600, 700 interviews we did post Black Saturday, everyone we spoke to knew they lived in a bushfire-prone area. Almost all of them said it wasn't a problem for them. And that is repeated time and time again. We are not getting that risk communication out. They know they live in a risky area. They don't internalise that risk. That is a very complex piece of risk communication we need to do. I'm not saying we have any answers to that yet. We're working on it. Why do people keep continuing to drive through floodwaters? We know that it's dangerous. People still do it. So there's a whole lot of that work that we need to understand, and what role does insurance play in that marketplace? What role does government play? What role do other actors play? It's time and time again people will say they didn't get warnings when we know they did. There's a whole load of that conscious decision making that people make about ignoring things they don't want to look at. The insurance findings in Black Saturday were actually quite interesting, because 95%, is that aligned with the 5% we had earlier, said they had insurance. Most of them didn't have insurance. They had house insurance, but they didn't have insurance for their businesses, which is what then led them to have problems. Just very briefly, we sat down with the whole sector and said, what are the big research priorities in the emergency management space? We published that recently. It's on our website if you want to have a look. Insurance was part of that. The critical things that spanned across there, where we still need to work, is the whole issue of shared responsibility of who owns the risk and who owns the mitigation. And the two are not necessarily the same, and the beneficiaries of risk mitigation are not the same people that have to spend the money. So there's a mismatch there between pain and benefit. we don't know how to communicate well enough yet. We need to understand better the impacts of climate change, particularly climate extremes, because that's where the damage is done. We need to get better at predictive services and warnings so that we can get out there sooner so we can prevent the damage. Just a little bit about the future. From our perspective, where does the research really need to go for the future for, I think, everybody across this sector? And I think it's all about the intersection of a bunch of key drivers. Number one is vulnerability. We're getting older. There are more of us. We are exposing ourselves to more and more hazards in different ways. That's linked in with demographic change. People are vulnerable in different ways at different times, so vulnerability isn't something like exposure, where you can measure it once and maybe walk away from it. Vulnerability changes with time and changes with people's financial positions, etc., and it can change almost on a daily basis. Demographic change will make that worse. More people will be exposed. New technologies, we're using stuff out there which is causing risk, whether it's cladding on the outside of buildings or whether it's new technologies around electricity storage and generation. And importantly, climate extremes. People don't get the message if you talk about a 2-degree average. They do get the message if you say the sorts of events we've seen this week in March, fires in New South Wales, fires in Victoria, are unusual but will become the norm. And those things that we never thought could ever happen will now become possible. So those sorts of issues, we need to start that process of communication. And how do we start to get people prepared? That's us. I had 10 minutes. Is that 10 minutes? You know? Oh, okay, I can keep talking. Which bit would you like me to go back to? Some of the other things that came out of post-fire work, we know, or post-impact work, we know the impacts of major events are not a one-off that can be solved by an injection of funds into a community. Thank you. We do know that it takes a very long time for a community to repair itself, if you like. We know that from the work that was being done, particularly following Black Saturday, that the communities are still seeing increased levels of domestic violence, of drug abuse, of alcohol abuse, of all of those signs of communities under stress almost 10 years later. We need to understand those impacts because that's what we're trying to prepare for. It's not as simple as rebuilding a house or rebuilding a community. We need to understand those because they have flow-on effects to other parts of the business, the health insurance sector and all those types of areas. We know that people don't like the choice, and go back to a fire example again. You can either stay and defend or you can leave early, which was the message around Black Saturday. We know that neither of those options is a good option. And the same applies to a flood. People don't want to leave. Because to leave means you're putting your house at the mercy of whatever will come. And if you stay, you're going to be putting your life at risk. So it doesn't like either of those. So what happens? People stay and wait and see. And that's one of the most dangerous things that people do. And that's why we see people out in cars being caught out or going to the beach, as it was the other day. We do need to better understand some of those things so that people can actually get prepared. We know that because they don't internalise the risk, they don't do things. They don't clear up around the house. They don't do anything to mitigate because, in their view, the other campaign I'm on is to get rid of the terminology of 1 in 100 or 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 50, because as soon as you start to talk likelihood to a community, they dismiss what you say afterwards. The consequence is not important. So if you say it's going to be discounted by a likelihood, they're switched off. They won't waste one of their 52 weekends doing something around the house to fix up, or they won't spend the money. We need to get out of that, and I don't think an annual exceedance probability works with the community either, so we need some other wording that we can use around that, because it's clearly not resonating with the community. I think we need to look at how do we use some of the business intelligence type activities that we use around nudge technology to try and, or nudge thinking to try and get people across the line to better understand and take ownership of the risk. Only then will we see a drop here off in insurance claims or a drop off in the impact of hazards. That's almost time.
There you go.